Thank you, folks. Great to see you. I'm Tom Ivey, an alcoholic and member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. Feel like a native of Salt Lake. I've been here, seemed like forever. I've been here a long time, and I think I've already talked to everybody in Salt Lake. So if it's redundant or repetitive, wasn't my fault. You showed up, and I just happened to be there. So I'm really glad to see you here, and congratulations to the group. This group continues to grow. And to Charlotte and Justin for an excellent, excellent presentation, both of them. Just did some great work. Charlotte was so good, we named our largest city in North Carolina after her. another girl from South of Charlotte. Looks like we got an exodus to Salt Lake. But I am pleased to be here, and I've had a good time here. It's good to see a bunch of old friends and dear friends. And it's very good to see some new friends. And for those of you who were new, introduce yourselves as being new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're anything like me, you may not feel like you just won the lottery, you know, because I know I didn't. And when I came in here, I thought it was the darkest day of my life. And it turned out to be the door to the brightest light I could possibly imagine. And I hope very much that that'll be your experience. And if you just get let go and let this thing work, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And so I do welcome you and wish you all the best. Now, I want to... Have y'all seen my coat? You like it? I mean, it's a lovely coat. It's second World War edition. And I'm getting out of the sucker. I'm over. Thank you, Lord. Now, I've satisfied the dress code. And it's hot in Utah, in case you hadn't noticed it. My God, I thought I came from hot country. We don't know hot. You guys know how to do it. I tell you that. I'm going to get on the plane in the morning and wish you well, because I'm heading back to cool off. So I want to do what we do, and that's to share my experience, strength, and hope. There's a great framework for what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We use the term speakers, but we don't have speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. What we have is storytellers. We're storytellers, and that's what we do. If you want to see an AA group just shut down, start making a speech to them, and you'll watch some blinders fall real quick. And some earplugs. And we don't do that. What we do is share our experience, strength, and hope. And I mentioned one of the workshops in Michigan. I think what frames the setting for an AA talk, very simple thing, is in Dr. Bob's story right toward the end of it. I think next to the last page. And what he's talking about is he's sort of talking to himself, and he writes that in the book. What was it about this man, referring to Bill, that was different from all the other people who had talked to me? Because I've talked with learned people and read many books, and he's a trained physician and, you know, an expert on many conditions. And what was it about this guy? He's a broken-down, decrepit banker a stockbroker from New York. And something happened that started to transform his life. He said, what was it about this guy? Then he answered his own question. He said, this man talked about his own experience. Didn't try to explain alcoholism. He talked about his own experience. And that's I think our book says, well, that frames what an AA talk is about. It's about our own experience, and hopefully it'll give hope. If I had any objective for this meeting other than keeping me sober, it would be to give hope to, and not necessarily just to new people. There are some people in fairly long-term sobriety who lose hope and get discouraged and get despondent and want to give up and don't know whether they ought to hang on or just throw it up and go take a break. And so to anybody who's sort of sagging in the harness, and anybody who's new to this program, I hope that you'll get hope from what I'm going to say. Now, I'm just a run-of-the-mill garden variety alcoholic. I was a guy... That I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of I'd love to. I mean, now I'm a guy who loves drunkalogs. I mean, I flat love them. Some people sort of put the bad mouth on drunkalogs. But if you listen to what Dr. Bob said and what he just wrote, what I'm going to say tonight, I love drunkalogs, particularly mine. I swear, I could listen to that sucker forever. And so I love them because that's what we connect with. We don't connect with lofty principles and theology and all that stuff. We connect with where we were broken and healed, and that can give hope to somebody like me. And so that's what I want to do. I was a guy that, I was conditioned by the stuff that everybody's conditioned by. I'm somebody who believes that you learn what you live. And so I grew up in an environment in which there were a lot of troubling factors. I won't enumerate them. I'd be glad to privately. I'd be glad to publicly. But I want to talk about some more stuff, too. And so I was a guy who experienced the slings and arrows of life like everybody does. And like everybody, I had to deal with the things that came my way. Some of them painful, some embarrassing, some hurtful, some good. And I was shaped by those things. And it's an interesting thing about how people deal with their experience. Some people have experiences and as a result become stronger than they would have otherwise been. You watch people who are handicapped, and oftentimes they perform better after the handicap than they did before because the body will rally, the spirit will rally, and it just happens. It's phenomenal to see. And those are people who respond in a healthy way to the things that happen. And there are others, of whom I was one, that react to the things that happen. And rather than responding and growing and developing new ways of coping with stuff, when I reacted, what I would do would be to get angry about it and then internalize the feelings. And as a result of just a number of things that happened, I grew up with a number of characteristics that we call defects of character. And they were things that went, it had to do with how I reacted to my life, and they developed the stuff that we call defects of character. An enormous amount of fear, insecurity, anger, embarrassment, guilt, you know, all kinds of stuff that were part of my life. Became an inveterate liar. And it was just the stuff that we call defects of character. And so I grew up with that kind of stuff, and it conditioned how I functioned in school, of how I could relate to other people. I was somebody who had extreme difficulty forming relationships with people. I know that's never been the case with anybody else in this room, but I had great difficulty having relationships with people, no matter who, particularly women. You know, I grew up in essentially a matriarchal society. My dad deserted family when I was 4. Oh, I thought you were attacking. You've got to be ready in Utah, man. You never know. I'm talking about a relationship with women. Here she comes. And so I grew up with that sort of inability. You know, I had with a really smother loving mother and an older sister. You know, anytime I would start to get into a relationship with mother, and I didn't think this through when it was happening, but when I got sober, started looking back, what would happen when I would start getting close to a female? I would see mother. You know. As I would react to that. And the fact is, by the way, I hope don't send, if this is being recorded, is it being recorded? Don't send it to North Carolina, please. I'm going to make a confession. And this girl reminded me of it tonight. She told me tonight that this is my 41st wedding anniversary today. I didn't know it. So don't send this recording to North Carolina. Good God, I won't be able to go home. And you can tell from that I got over the difficulty of having relationships with women. But it was a real problem, you know. And it was because of that sort of fear of getting smothered in it again, just like I did with my mother. But it generalized over to males as well. I couldn't have intimate relationships with people where I would have trust and give them access to my life. Because I just didn't trust anybody. And so I wouldn't let anybody give me anything for a long, long time. I'd take it away from them. Didn't mind that. Because you don't get attached to somebody you take something from. You do get attached if they give you something. And so I wouldn't let anybody give me anything because that way they get into my life. So that's the way I grew up, with that kind of warped way of dealing with life. And those are what we call defects of character. And so I carried those things. And when I started to drink, I found the magic solution for those things that drove my life. And I fell in love with booze right from the very beginning. I wasn't an alcoholic. I drank like one. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just a guy who found magical relief in that stuff, and I would have been a fool to not drink. Cheapest therapy I ever had in my life, before or since. A lot cheaper than psychiatry. More effective, too. Yeah, I get enough pops going, man, I didn't have any problems. I'd be telling you how to solve yours. And so that thing really worked for me, and it freed me. And amazingly, what freed me also imprisoned me as well. So I was a guy that was just a ready-made candidate to have problems with alcohol, to have alcohol have an exaggerated importance in my life. So when I started to drink purposefully at about 16, that it was just instantly a very important thing in my life. And I honestly believe that from the point that I really felt the impact of alcohol in my life, I don't think I ever, from that point forward, took an unimportant drink. Didn't make any difference. If it was just draining the corners out when I run out of booze, I never took an unimportant drink. It was never just a liquid to me. It was a magical kind of a thing that changed the way I felt and related to the world. And so I just fell in love with it and was not alcoholic. I just was a pig. I absolutely fell in love with that stuff. It took off. Now, I didn't like where I was. Part of that whole shaping thing that went on as a child, I didn't like where I was. Didn't like anything about it. I despised that town. I despised everything about it. They had some nice folks in there, and some weren't so nice. I was one of them. But I just didn't like it. I wanted out of Dodge. And I tell you the darn truth, I still don't like that town. My sister lives there. Poor soul. I don't guess she knows any better. But I'm one, the only time I get homesick is when I go home. And I'll get homesick in a heartbeat, and I get out of there in a heartbeat. So, but that's where it was. And then when I was 16 and started drinking, and I coerced my mother into lying about my age so I'd go in the military. Went in the military at 16. And that was in 1948, not the First World War. The second one was just over. And that army was filled up with leftovers from the Second World War. And they were a grizzled bunch. I mean, these were some rough cases that were there. And then here's this pipsqueak kid that I'm in there looking like Doogie Howser in the... And I felt about like Doogie. I think I didn't even need to shave. I did. I mean, I hated to be the only thing there not shaving. So I'd get up there and shave. There wasn't nothing there. I didn't need a blade. I'd just shave. And I'm trying to fit in, you know. And man, I'm in there with slicksters from Utah. And the guys wearing shades at night. You know, I mean, this is before it became trendy. I mean, these folks, something else. And then here's this goofus from North Carolina. And I didn't adapt well. I loved the military for about 30 minutes. And then I met the first guy in charge. Never seen the fella before in my life. He started talking to me like a dog. Well, I mean, you don't do that where I came from. You might stick somebody on Saturday night, but you don't just put them down in the right out in the public. And so I didn't like it. You know, I didn't like it one bit. I fell out of love with the Army before I even got in it real good. And I started quitting on a regular basis. I found out you don't quit the Army. It ain't like working at a service station. So every time I'd quit, they'd come get me and put me in jail. And so I finally quit quitting. And they had started out to groom me to be an officer. They changed their minds very quickly when they saw me in action. And I spent my military career up in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. I got to go back to Alaska in September, not to the Aleutians. I'm not going back there. I don't care what they got going. But that's where I spent my military career. Now, I was a guy, as I indicated, I was a guy for whom alcohol had a tremendous importance. I wasn't yet alcoholic. I was just a guy who totally appreciated and enjoyed what alcohol did for me. And when I wound up on the Aleutian Islands, here I am, just a pink-cheeked little kid, just 16 years old, and I'm stuck on a rock in the Bering Sea. And I never could figure out why I was there. I mean, what's to do on a dumb rock in the Bering Sea? Got a gun. I'm supposed to shoot something, I guess. Never did know what. I didn't see anything to shoot but a walrus or something like that. I don't want to shoot a walrus. And I guess if somebody's trying to break in the rock, or, well, it's just stupid. You know? and I thought, I'm standing up there freezing to death. Didn't he have the decency to snow down? It snowed sideways. I mean, you'd be standing there and the snow would just blow you off the rock. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? You know, and so, and I solved that problem. I got drunker than a billy goat every chance I got and did my best to stay that way. And we had a lot of health freaks who would get out and run up and down the rock like a bunch of zebras or something. And they were health people. I knew there was something wrong with them up there doing that. And we shipped a whole boatload of them home who were those health freaks who were getting out there living pure and all that. They went nutty as a fruitcake. And we loaded them up, shipped them off. The drunks were laying up there fat and happy. Most of the time, I didn't know if I was in the Aleutians or in Hawaii. I knew I wasn't in where our body was lying. And so that's what it was. I was just a guy. I don't think being in the Aleutians caused my alcoholism at all. I think my alcoholism was already formed. I started treating it with alcohol when I was 16 years old. It gave me ease and comfort, and it helped me through the night. From 16. And then, best I can tell, after I got sober looking back, seemed to me like where my drinking changed from just wild, crazy drinking into uncontrolled drinking or alcoholism, best I could tell, was when I was roughly in my 18th year. And I was on that rock. And what happened was nothing dramatic that was visible. I didn't drink anymore. I drank as much as I could before I was alcoholic. When you get so drunk you can't lay on the floor, that's about as good as it gets. You know, I don't care whether you're alcoholic or not. You ain't going to get no drunker than that. And so I did that. But something happened when I was 18 that we just sort of colloquially refer to as crossing a line. Not written anywhere. But every old member of Alcoholics Anonymous used to be just the language about crossing the line. And I don't know when I crossed that line. I'm quite sure I was drunk at the time and probably would not have noticed a nuance like crossing a line. And so but what happened, and I got sober, looked back, I could see that that's where my drinking changed in the sense that it was no longer just a wild kind of party, you know, that was just seemingly endless, where I honestly believe during that period I could probably have quit had I wanted. But when I crossed that line, my life changed in the sense that if I took a drink, I could not predict what I would do. Could not predict how long I would drink, what I would do when I drank, where I would go. I became a guy who was powerless over alcohol. Alcoholism was full-blown in my life. Booze soothed it for a while. But then when I lost control of my drinking, I had the physical allergy, the physical illness of alcoholism, coupled with that mental obsession. It's like it says in the book, our problem centers primarily in the mind. Very definite physical factor. But the troubling aspect of alcoholism, the physical factor of alcoholism will never bother me again. As long as I live, it will never bother me again. I will never experience craving again unless I take one drink. The physical illness is at rest. And the only thing I'd have to do is just light the flame and look out, Charlie. And so what I'm left with is dealing with that strange mind of a chronic alcoholic. And so that's what happened when I was 18. I developed alcoholism, and I had no clue of that. I just knew that I was just a guy that I bummed out a lot. Now, it wasn't all just a party going awry. You know, I started to have extremely embarrassing, humiliating experiences. I never did tell anybody they were embarrassing, humiliating experiences, but they were. And they would hurt deeply, but I would do my darndest to make sure nobody knew it hurt. I give just one example. I don't usually talk about it. It's too soon after dinner. But I'll tell it anyway and take a risk. I didn't even know this. I went to work, whatever I thought I was doing. Got at lunchtime, took a break and took a fifth and got just totally drunk. All I know about it is exactly what was reported, and I had no clue. I drank that booze and then just blacked out, and for some strange reason went into the dining room. They call it a mess hall, and when I got in there, it lived up to the name because I made a mess out of that hall. And I went in there, and here's a couple hundred guys trying to have lunch. I walk in, and I don't want to make you feel queasy, but I walked in with a tray of food, as was reported to me, sat down, promptly threw up in the food, and fell over in it. And that's, you're on a high, eh? You're really on a high when you're doing that. And somebody drugged me back into to the bunk area. And when I came to, there are always some helpful citizens around that don't want to talk with you about what you did. And I had some guy came over to me and said, "Let me tell you what you did, man." I said, "All right, what now?" And so he told me what I did. And I said, weakly, but the only thing I could think of, I said, "Well, we all had a good laugh, didn't we?" He said, "Yeah, we did, but everybody's laughing at you." Excuse me. "Nobody's laughing with you." Now, I wouldn't let him know it for the world, but that hurts. That hurts. I think that's the first time anybody ever really penetrated through that veneer and got to where I lived. Now, I didn't do anything about it, but I never forgot it. And that was the first time anybody ever really alerted me that my behavior wasn't quite up to par with the rest of the world. And so I stumbled on around in the military for screwing up everything I got close to. They finally got tired of it. They shipped me back to the States, and I was reviewed by a team of officers in December of 51, and they were reviewing me about my future. Now, back then, they didn't have programs in the military to reclaim lost soldiers and you know, treatment, stuff like that. That didn't exist. And so back then, the only thing they'd do was if they couldn't intimidate you into quitting, they'd just throw you out. And that's what happened. Those guys talked to me. I'm 20 years old. And they talked to me about my drinking and my performance, which I didn't particularly want to hear about. And then the guy said to me, we're going to discharge you. And he handed me a piece of paper, and the paper said, "Undesirable discharge, - unfit for military service." 20-year-old young guy. - alcoholism. I lost the paper in some drunken mess, but I'll guarantee you I never forgot the message. And so I was discharged on the 28th of December of 51. Knew I'd walk out and have a life, and I did, but it wasn't the life I had in mind, and all I did is continue on. I didn't know that from then on my future was predictable, but to anybody but me. I was a guy who had tremendous opportunities. When I had a remarkable ability to snap back. I was somebody who always made a good impression on people. I mean, I could be sober 2 days, and I'd look like a real star, you know. And so I've got more opportunities than a human ought to have. Screwed up every one of them. I had a remarkable tendency to take a drink at exactly the wrong time. And every time I took a drink at the wrong time, no matter what it was gone. And so that was the story of my life. And it was essentially a story of just failures and new starts and failures and new starts. And what I failed to reckon with or think much about was that every time I failed and started over, I started a little lower than I was and a little lower than I was. And then I gradually worked my way to a place in society that I didn't even know about. I mean, I grew up in a rough little old neighborhood, but I didn't know there were places in this world that were just absolutely pits of despair. I mean, I lived up in the state of Michigan in a city called Flint. And you've probably heard of Flint, Michigan. Roger Moore wrote a very timely and accurate book about Flint, Michigan. And it's been voted twice the worst city in the United States in which to live. That's where I lived. I lived in the worst section of the worst city in the United States of America. And by the time I got there, it felt normal. It was absolutely foreign to anything I had ever experienced in my growing up, and it felt normal. Strange thing. You know, our book, I'll just mention this, and then I don't even know what time it is. It's now 10:30 in North Carolina. For whatever that's worth. You do one of those when it's time. She's vicious. So, that's just going on. And in our book, it sort of describes the frame of mind that I had. Where in our book, it refers to how people like me see a life like that and fail to respond to it. And it uses two words. One word that's very descriptive to me is delusion, an inability to differentiate the true from the false. And the other word uses it, illusion, an inability to see life as it is, to see the world as it is. And that explains a lot to me as I was ratcheting my way down. I was a guy, a wino could have diagnosed me, for God's sakes, but I couldn't. And so what I'm doing, I'm just going notch by notch, just going on down until I was living a kind of life I didn't even know existed. Yeah, I didn't know people lived like that. And by the time I got there, it was normal. I felt very normal. I fit right in to the worst part of the worst city in this country. And I was at home. It was a place where there was, I don't know if there was any economy that meant anything or not, but there was an economic system, and it consisted of he who is friskiest drinks most. And which that meant was that in that society you were either the rollee, that means you got rolled, or you were the roller. It meant you were a little friskier than the other guy. And I'm living in that kind of a jungle, and it seemed normal. It was the way it worked. You know, somebody rolled you. You didn't call the police because you hadn't much chance of locking you up as him. So it was just the society. It was the economy of that place. So my blood, $5 a throw. And I would have literally have let them pump me dry if they hadn't had controls and kept up with who they were draining. Yeah, but otherwise I would have had no restraint or any kind of rational handling of that. And so that's who I was. That was rough enough. Just the physical journey of alcoholism. But the part of it, like some of you heard me this week and say that my favorite definition is the one that was read here tonight. In that third chapter, about halfway down the page, there's one line that really says something very important to me. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. I love that definition because it has nothing to do with how much I drank, how long I drank, what I did when I drank, how many times I've been married, how many times I've been in jail. Has absolutely nothing to do with it. Those things are just drunken circumstances. I mean, that's what drunks do, is goofy stuff. Not about alcoholism. I know genuine, self-respecting alcoholics who've never been in jail. There's probably some in here that are guilty of never having gone to jail. I always kind of feel, where were they? I mean, how could you be really drunk and not get caught sometime, And we did a survey in Charlotte, in a town that's named after you guys. Did a survey in Charlotte in 1960. And in 1960, we had real alcoholics. Man, we didn't have wimps. We had real alcoholics. Hairy-legged alcoholics. We did a little nose count, and one of the questions on that was, have you ever been in jail as much as one time? 30% had. 70% had never been in jail for 1 minute. Many of them, just absolutely blew my mind, had the same job all during their alcoholism. My God. I don't even know how many jobs I had. I'd forget where I worked sometime. I never did. I had a boss one time tell me I was the best employee he ever had 3 days a week. The rest of the time out of history. I see somebody that's worked on some job 40 years that's an alcoholic. I think, good God, you had lousy supervision. That's, but anyway, that's why I love that definition. We're men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And it has nothing to do with Wild West stories and circumstances and how far you can throw up straight up in the air. Has nothing to do with that. It's literally for me, it's about dying on the inside. not the trouble you get into on the outside. It's about dying on the inside. And I can remember in the madness of that, sometime when I'd be trying to brush my teeth and look at myself at the mirror and just want to gag at what I'm seeing. Or look in there and the best thing I can think of is, good God, man, why don't you just end it? And I'm talking about a guy in his late teens and early 20s. You're really on a roll when that's the best you can come up with. That's alcoholism. It's the private illness of what happens on the inside. You know, an awful lot of people tell me they've never been in prison. I tell you this, I have never been in a tighter prison than the prison of alcoholism. Owned me. And so that's what was happening. I was just crashing through life. I knew a guy like me was going to come to no good end. I knew there was no question about it. And I did. I sort of morbidly predicted I probably would make it 29 years and no more. I don't know why I picked that, but I did, but obviously it didn't happen. But I think it would have probably been pretty accurate if I hadn't been brought to stop. I do have a lot of friends, and many people know. My story is your story. Yours might not have happened, but it's the same story. I don't know of an alcoholic who, particularly those who have had blackouts, who haven't lived in terror of what they might do while they're drunk and blacked out. Thank God the things we fear most never happen to most alcoholics, but sometimes they do. And I was one of those. I came to a jail one morning, assumed I was in there for the same as always, either drunk, hustling, scuffling on the street or whatever. Thought it'd be the same old. And after I was awake for just a little while, the jailer came by, and I knew him. We were well acquainted. And when he came by, I said, hey, guy, when can I get out? And he said, I hope never. He walked off. I had no clue what he was talking about, but I knew he wasn't kidding. He was serious as a heart attack. And he walked on, and I went back into the drunk tank, and some guy in there told me that the night before, there'd been a guy driving drunk down the main street of the city and had struck and killed two people, and that I had been arrested for the crime. And I tell you, that was information. I understood the words, but I couldn't handle the message. And I just refused to believe I could have done something like that. And I just refused to accept the information for a while and then gradually accept the truth. I'd done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. But that happens daily in this country, and I know that. And so I'm looking at that. I was not a subhuman. I was not somebody who was insensitive to human life. And being responsible for the deaths of two people was more than I could handle. And I just refused to believe it. I could believe it, but I couldn't deal with it. And then gradually accepted that truth. And my response was, I just wanted to disappear. I had absolutely no, first time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. I didn't want out. I was afraid to get out. I was ashamed to get out. I was ashamed to be breathing, for God's sakes. Never mind being on the street and meeting people. I had no desire whatsoever. And I'll never know why, nor will I ever try to find out, but there was some policeman. I was really in bad shape. And I was almost comatose. I was just so in shock and grief that some policeman, I guess, saw the shape of it. And he checked my record, saw I had family in North Carolina, called my folks. And my family did what families do far too often. I sometimes think families of alcoholics are punished more than the alcoholic. I truly believe that. Because they have to deal with it sober. At least we have the oblivion of to them. But anyway, they kind of, my family couldn't afford a trip to Michigan, but they made it anyway. They couldn't afford an attorney. They got one anyway. I didn't want out of jail, but I didn't know how to say that to anybody. And so they did what they did, and then finally I was released on bonds on the 17th of July of 1956. I knew that I would never drink again. I mean, my God, how could you possibly drink after having done something as horrible as that? If you understand anything about alcoholism, the more likely question is, how would you not drink? But I didn't know anything about that. I didn't think I was alcoholic. I'd been thrown out of the military for it. Didn't mean a thing. I didn't think I was alcoholic. I just thought that anybody with that kind of weight on them, how could you possibly pick up a drink? Walked the streets all day. The first day I was out on the 17th, walked all night, and about noon the next day. And then I started to drink, of course. and from the 18th of July till the 19th of November, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. And that's not some idle Wild West, you know, calculation. I've worked literally with thousands of alcoholics. Not a few. I have worked with thousands of alcoholics. I've never worked with one like me. I held an alcoholic in my arms one night on a 12-step call while he died. And even as he died, he was not an alcoholic like me, because he was still fighting. He was still protesting as he died. And I just gave into it. I mean, I didn't make a rational decision. I just gave into it. And I don't have any question whatsoever that I was trying to drink myself to death. I think the only reason I didn't overtly commit suicide is I didn't want to leave another burden on a family who'd already been a burden too long. And that's the only reason I didn't do it. And then so I just stayed everything I could possibly do to stay drunk till the 19th of November. Then that morning I was going to be tried, and I took what I hope and pray was my last drink. I had a bottle of gin, and just a piece of a bottle of gin, and I finished it off and went to court. Knew I wouldn't be back. I knew it was a one-way trip. I had no defense. You know, the hell of blackouts is that you can't even explain behavior that you don't know anything about. And so when I went into trial, I was listening to the trial as if I were on the jury, because it was all new to me. When I heard a policeman testify who investigated the crime, he described what was there, first time I'd ever heard it. And so that when I went into that trial, I didn't have any question that I would be found guilty. And yeah, I've often thought it didn't happen, and it's just conjecture, but I've often thought that the toughest punishment I could have been given would have been if the judge had just said, go live with yourself. That would have done it. But that's not what happened, and I was found guilty, sentenced that day to a sentence of 5 to 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. And I'd never been around that. I'd been in jails God knows how many times, but it was always lightweight stuff, you know, just kind of social nuisance stuff. And I never had been in a prison or anything like that. I never even seen one to know what I was looking at. But I knew what it was like. I knew that it was full of guys like I'd been doing on the street with. I knew who was in there. And those were not model citizens, so I knew it had to be some kind of a joint. And so when I walked in, I know when that judge passed that sentence, I had an instinctive reaction of fear, just a normal human reaction. But simultaneously, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. There wouldn't be any more. I'm not talking about happy ending, or I'll get some help. That was not even a thought in my mind. I thought, it's done. It's done. Now, it's like, kind of like a guy who's experienced near-death experiences. They invariably will talk about the feeling of peace or sometimes even euphoria that comes when they think they have died. And that's sort of what I was. I felt a sense that it's over. It's over. It's done. And next day I was taken into that place. I was led into the prison through a gate, chained with five other guys, and walked in. I knew when I walked in there that I wouldn't come out alive, that I knew if I came out, it would be toes up. So when I walked in, I was truly a guy in bad shape. I was totally isolated. I'd always been essentially an isolated type of person. I made a lot of noise when I was drunk, but my instinct was to isolate and not get close. And that just came out in spades in there. I just totally isolated. Didn't talk to anybody about anything. Didn't visit. Didn't know who was in the cell on either side of me. And it wasn't I didn't care. They just didn't exist. And I just sat there, just going to let my life end in that place. And then some stuff happened. It's amazing how simple it is. When you finally look at it, I'll tell you this, and it's a fact. If it had been necessary for me to be sensitive to my needs and look for help, I would have died in that penitentiary, because I would never have done it. I have no question about that. And back then, this was way back when there was no such as treatment or intervention or detoxes or anything like that. And so it was just a crude way of handling things, and I would have never asked for help. I didn't even know there was any help for an alcoholic. The only thing I knew you did with alcoholics was hit him upside the head with a blackjack, put him in jail. That's the only detox I knew. And so I knew nothing about that stuff. Checked in, a guy was doing an intake deal on me where they go over your social history and your habits and all that stuff. guy went through my record, and it's a big, thick one, and it's all about drunk and something. And so he went through all that. He got through. He said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah. I mean, my God, that's obvious. And he said words I'd never heard. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution. I think you ought to go. Now, this was far from the mandating stuff we do today. Far from that. This was just a guy giving some friendly suggestion. He couldn't have cared less. He'd have made the same amount the next day as he did that day, well, no matter what I did. And that's just coercive kind of stuff was not on the board yet. And so he just made that statement. And I had no clue what he's talking about. I'd never heard of AA. Never heard of it. I had no clue what he's talking about. Didn't ask any questions. I was not in a communicating condition at that time. I didn't ask him what it was. And it meant nothing to me. He might as well have said you need to join the Salt Lake Symphony or something. That would have meant as much to me as that. And so I left, went back to my cell. A few days later, I got a little note on a piece, little strip of paper, said you can go to your first AA meeting, February 2nd of 57. And I didn't want to go to. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't care whether it was AA or ZZ. It wouldn't have mattered to me what it was. I didn't want to go anywhere. Isolated people, last thing they want to do is go yuck it up with somebody. That's the last thing. And so, but I was blessed. I was truly blessed with what I think is the most beautiful word you hear in relation to recovery. And that's surrender. Surrender. Thank God I was totally beat. Totally beat. Had no fight left. I mean, none. And when I got that note, I didn't thoughtfully consider that and make a decision to go. I was just like a trained monkey or something. I got that thing, and I just got up when they announced to go, and I just went over there. Had no clue where I was going. I thought it was going to be something like they did in county jails where clean old people would come in from churches and give their testimony and pray and then sing. And anytime they sang Amazing Grace, man, I'd just crumble. And I'd start bawling and enjoying whatever they were selling. It didn't matter what it was. And it'd last all 30 minutes. And But that's what I figured it was going to be something along that line. And I went down and went to the school building. We had a huge group there. I say we because it became we. But we had a huge group there. We had 6,338 or some guys locked up behind one wall. And I'm just one more lost fish in a great big pond. And when I walked in, naturally, there was a huge crowd. That group had 300 people in it, 300 members. And I walked up, they had an officer on the door, and he read my name on the shirt, Ivester. I said, yes, sir, and he said, sit down. And I sat down in the middle of my first AA meeting. Had no clue. Some of you are sitting in close to the first meeting. But I tell you what, you can't possibly feel any more out of place than I did if you don't feel like you're home yet. You cannot feel any more out of place. I walked in there. Now, I was a guy who was totally shut down on anything that even rhymed with religion. I mean, I wasn't mad at God. He just wasn't nobody there. You know, I might have had no belief whatsoever in anything spiritual at all. And I figured it was going to be some kind of a religious hootenanny of some sort. And so I go in. First thing they did was pray. We did the prayer here tonight, that serenity prayer. And when they did the prayer, they were praying, and I'm thinking to myself, yep, just what I thought. Just what I thought. They'll be in here with the guitars and leaping and jumping. And it didn't happen, thank God. Then they read a bunch of stuff. I swear to God, we read more stuff in AA than any place I know. But they read a bunch of stuff. Sounded like scripture to me. I didn't know what all that stuff was. And their poetry or something. And then they got through reading, introduced speaker. Guy got up to told his story. Now, I'd been around alcoholics of every flavor, all around places. That guy got up and told his story, and I thought, what on earth is he doing that for? I mean, it didn't make sense to me. He was a decent-looking guy if you didn't get close to him. He didn't stand close examination very well. He was one beat-up dude, and he'd been a professional boxer at one time, and apparently not a good one, because he was marked up big time. And so I listened to him, and he's telling that story. And I thought, why on earth would somebody get up there and bare their soul like this to 300 convicts? Made no sense. And so I listened to what was going on. I'd never heard anything like that. I didn't identify with one syllable of any word he uttered, not one. But the next week, and I left truly more confused than I was when I went in. But the next week I was back. I was back. You know, I said I wanted to give some hope. Yeah, and it's just a simple, fragile thing like hope. God is so important. And I'll tell you what I got from my first meeting and what brought me back. It wasn't hope particularly, but that guy who spoke that day was without question the most enthusiastic man I had ever seen in my life. He was so enthusiastic and so carried away with what he's doing. When he spoke, he would just stumble over his own words. He's going so fast. And a marvelous man. He became my first sponsor a year later. I didn't know what a sponsor was when I heard him, but if anybody told me I was going to match up with that guy, I'd say, no, he weird boy. But he was a marvelous, marvelous servant in AA. And so what brought me back was the spirit of the guy, not the message of the guy, the spirit of the guy. And that magnetic appeal of that enthusiasm brought me back. I couldn't have told anybody why I was sitting there. Nobody asked. Nobody cared. I mean, those guys got their own troubles. My God, they're not worried about where's that guy was here last week. Nobody would have missed me. I wouldn't have missed it. Nobody would look for me. But I was drawn back, thank God. And then I started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't join right away. I didn't truly believe I was an alcoholic. I'm 24 years old. I didn't think alcoholics came in real full bloom at 24. So I didn't really think I was one. I knew I was a bad drunk. I knew I'd gotten in a lot of trouble. But they were talking about alcoholism being a disease. And I found that a very embarrassing concept for some reason. It was an embarrassing concept. What's a disease about getting drunk? And that was how simplistically I looked at it. And I could not put that together. The medical association started to present alcoholism as a disease about the time I came to AA. But just because the medical association started to call it a disease doesn't mean the society believed that. I heard that. It didn't change my thoughts about it. I thought alcoholism was a moral issue, and so did most of the country. And so that didn't mean a lot. And so I just kept going back. I listened to people tell their stories. You know, I said how important that experience is. Like, I know what I'm trying to say to you folks, but I don't have a clue what you're hearing. It's none of my business. You're in charge of what you hear. I'm in charge of trying to share to the best of my ability what my story of failure and recovery was about. And so what I heard when I heard people tell their story was that they were alcoholic because when they drank, they got in trouble. And I thought, well, my God, if that's what it is, I've had that all my life. Man, I've been in trouble all my life, and I've never been in jail sober in my life or arrested or wrestled to the ground. Yeah, every time I've ever been in trouble, I was drunk. I said, well, that's not a profound understanding of alcoholism, is it? But I'll tell you what the value was. It was enough to keep me in the chair. It was enough to keep me there. So I'm very thankful for that. I stayed in there 3.5 years, never missed a single meeting, whether it was once a day or every day. But we did. We met regularly one time a week. We took over the entire school building. We'd do an open speaker meeting 1 week, and next week we'd break into step groups and use every classroom in the school. It was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God. If it hadn't been, I guarantee you, I wouldn't be here tonight. But it was a fine group, did a good job of taking newcomers and helping them figure out what this program's about. We didn't take people through the book and through the steps back then, but what we basically did is just put a hands-on kind of a thing of here's what it is, here's how it is. I fumbled my way through the steps. Nobody ever took me through them. I never went to a big book workshop for the first 20 years I was sober. Simple reason, there weren't any. We didn't do a lot of that kind of stuff. We was basically action-oriented. And so I just fumbled my way through the steps. But I'll tell you this. It's not just my belief. It's my knowledge. Is that if you work these steps to the best of your ability, as honestly as you know how, when you get through, you'll be a different dude. You'll be a different dude. And it doesn't matter what your thinking is when you start, because if you take those actions when you get through, your thinking will be right. And that's exactly what happened to me. That's why I say that authoritatively, because it's exactly what happened. I fumbled my way through, and I had an absolutely transforming experience in recovery in a maximum custody zoo. I became a free man. Not physically, of course, but I became a free man in the ways that matter. in the matter of the spirit. I was a free spirit. I was somebody who was alive and functioning for the first time in my life in a very real and connected way with the world around me. And so it was a truly transforming thing. My very strong reality came. I'm not going to visit much of the steps, even though they're the heart and soul. They are the program. They're not the heart and soul. They are the program. But I'm going to just speed read through. The profound thing for me came in the fourth step. When I made that searching and fearless moral inventory, nobody ever coached me on how to do it, but I was always been a reader. I read the book very quickly when I got in. And one day a guy spoke at our meeting, and he spoke for the entire meeting about the fourth step, about inventory. And he got through talking about it, and I thought, well, geez, I think I'll try that. Went back to my cell, got out that old trusty long yellow legal pad and a number two pencil, sat down, and I didn't mean to write my inventory, you know, as it's laid out in the book. I meant to write a pitiful story about how such a nice fella as me got in such a mess. That's what I meant to do, was explain to the world that I'm not really that kind of guy, you know. I'm really a good fella underneath. I think that's what I was going to do. I started to write, and the founders who wrote the book were wise when they said, write the inventory. I started to write that fantasy. Now, you believe this, because it's an absolute fact. I wrote two lines of what I had in mind. And then all at once, with no thought, no preparation, no chart to go by, no instruction to go by, all at once, it was as if I hit a wall. Nothing dramatic happened, but all at once, I just stopped writing what I was writing, and in one swoop, opened up and just started to pour out my heart and did my inventory. A learned person, a shrink, would say that what I did was a cathartic experience. I don't care what it was. It was the most important experience I ever had in my life. Because when I got through with that inventory, it might have been ugly to the world, but it was the place where I knew without any question that I was alcoholic. Without any question. You know, the hook was sunk in me deeply. Because I knew I was alcoholic. I'm not the young guy with a big problem. I was not the tragic case. I was not the fellow with a lot of potential. I knew I was alcoholic, that I'm somebody who simply can't drink. That happened that day when I did that inventory, and 52 years later, I have never doubted it for one second. What it gave me was a very realistic foundation in AA. And it gave me a steady course. It gave me a long view of sobriety so that I'm not just going to fall into any crisis that comes along. Instead, I'm looking the long view. I want to stay sober the rest of my life. And I know I can. If I can do it one day at a time, if I do the things that are laid out freely for me to do. And so that was a transforming place for me. I became a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous then, in every sense of the word. And I've never wavered on that. And the fifth, I did the fifth. Some people say you got to have special surroundings. That's not necessarily so. I did my fifth step with a fellow inmate sitting on what looked like a park bench in a maximum custody penitentiary. I'm bribing her for a couple more minutes. And it could not have been better had I done it over in the temple. Could not have been better. And so that my life was starting to happen. And there's nothing, you know, if you don't think it's a powerful program, that place I was in was literally a jungle. I've been in penitentiaries around the world. I would rate that the third worst penitentiary I have ever seen. Place where man's inhumanity to man was routine behavior. Where kindness was weakness, sincerity was stupidity. And I found freedom there, found freedom. I found useful purpose, found dignity, found integrity, all of the stuff that came. I learned how to function like a human in an unbelievably inhuman environment, powerful program. I learned how to serve. I learned how to have useful purpose. And so I stayed 3.5 years, and that was the minimum eligibility on a 15-year max. Did 3.5 years, and they reviewed me for parole and paroled me to North Carolina. I hit the streets. I'm going to have to tell you this in a hurry. I hit the streets with the dreams that anybody has when they come out of whatever cage they're in. All of us have been in cages. They're just different kinds. And I came out with the little, I just had small dreams. I just wanted to be a citizen for the first time in my life. I wanted to have a job. I wanted to pay taxes I never had. I never filled out an income tax form in my life. And so I wanted to be a citizen. I certainly wanted to be free. I wanted to have some useful purpose. I got immediately active in AA the first day I hit the street, and I haven't stopped since. And amazing, miraculous, marvelous things happened to me. My driver's license was restored to me 2 months after I was out with a crime like mine. And I never once even suggested I'd like that to happen. People saw what I was doing. They saw the work I was doing. And that was restored to me with no action on my part. What I firmly believe, no, I don't believe it, I know it. I know that when God has work for us to do, not when I want to do it, but when God has work for us to do, the walls that separate us from it will come down. And they surely have for me. 2 years after I was out, I got a phone call one day from our state capital, from the prison headquarters. The guy on the phone was a guy I'd met once just for a couple of minutes and howdy dude with. And he was an official with the prison system. It was him on the phone. And he asked for Mr. Ivester. I got on the phone. And he said, Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system. And we were wondering, now you think of who he's talking to. You know, I am a convicted felon who's on parole from a maximum custody penitentiary in another state. That's who he's talking to. I've been on the streets 2 years. I'm still on parole to that penitentiary. And he said, we're expanding the rehabilitation program. We were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. And first thing I said, just instinctively, I said, do you know who you're talking to? And he said, yeah, we know. We've checked you out. And certainly they had, you know. And I, to him, I said, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine. To myself, you know what I said. Ain't no way. As of that phone call, there had never been a person in the history of this planet hired as a professional employee in a prison system. I knew that. And I knew they weren't going to start with me. But when God has work for us to do, the walls do come down, including those. And I was employed as a professional in the system and had an absolutely marvelous career for 39 years. Absolutely marvelous career. Went to the top of my profession, literally to the top of my profession. And absolutely great. And I'll tell you this, it sounds almost like an unbelievable fairy tale, but it's a God's truth. From the moment of my first job until I retired, I never applied for a single job, promotion, or anything else. What I did was give my very best to everything I did. And I learned that there's a real hunger for people who will do that and give and autograph it with excellence because my work tells you who I am. And so people started to recruit me, and I went to the top of my system and then retired when I found out I was the oldest rat in the barn. And I said, shoot, I didn't want to be that. Also found out I'd make as much retired as I did working. So even I could figure that out. So I went to work, and the day after I retired, I became the chairman of AA Service Work in Corrections the day I retired, day after I retired. And my wife was so thrilled. She said, you've got to be kidding. You, God knows, man, you're crazy. And so I'm wide open. I'll tell you this. Now, I don't tell this to anybody because they're not going to believe it. I'm 76 years old. And be 77 coming up very soon. That's old. That is old. But not to me. I'm as wound up today as I was 52 years ago. I'm as enthusiastic in Alcoholics Anonymous today as I was 52 years ago. I'm as fired with imagination and creativity and commitment as I've ever been. Some people will tell you, but don't listen to them too long if they tell you. Some people will tell you that there's a rather predictable trajectory in recovery, that you'll go through it. If you work the program, you'll sort of get on a pink cloud. You know, you'll sort of have a honeymoon period. And then after a certain interval, you'll taper off that end of something. I don't know what, mediocrity, I guess. But whatever, you're supposed to taper off. Let me tell you something. You never have to come off. I never have. I am still as pumped as I've ever been. What I've found is that when I'm committed to this program, I'm giving my very best to carry the message to other people. Man, that paint cloud's there. And I'm going to stay on that sucker. People have been telling me to slow down for 40 years. Everybody that tells me, I take a look at them and say, if I slow down now, am I going to be like you? And no thanks. I'm going to keep on hopping. So again, I welcome, if you're new here, I welcome you here. Give yourself to this simple program and you will be amazed at what happens. Thanks.